Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, October 4th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. The last weeks have seen an extraordinary series of developments which, taken as a whole, have changed the whole geopolitical strategic picture on the globe. The emergence of the BRICS nations with their aggressive commitment to economic development has been gaining support daily from nations such as Bolivia, Thailand, and at the same time, the transatlantic nations are trapped in a crisis of their own making, one of endless wars and financial bankruptcy. And no amount of lying by Obama about the so-called Great Recovery can overcome the fact that the United States has fewer people working today, a smaller percentage of people working today than it had since 1978, and there's a desperation just beneath the surface in the United States. Lyndon LaRouche pointed out in his weekly Friday webcast that the U.S., the U.K., and Europe, the main forces of the transatlantic nations, can do a lot of damage through war and destabilizations, but so far they've shown no ability to present solutions. And that's why we see the emergence of the BRICS as a counterpole to the otherwise collapsing system. It was at the annual United Nations General Assembly events of the last 2 weeks that the evidence of this divergence of these two systems was so clearly put on display. While leaders of BRICS nations such as Brazil's Dilma Rousseff, India's Narendra Modi, as well as individuals such as Argentina's Cristina Kirchner, spoke of bringing into being a new era of development with an emphasis on creating a future for the youth of the world, President Obama could emit only lies and threats in defense of his failed policies. Today on the LaRouche Show, we will take a deeper look into this process of the BRICS with a focus on the Prime Minister of India, Modi, whose trip to the United States allowed him to speak to the American people. And he came across as a true leader. Lyndon LaRouche described him as a unique figure, as a statesman who possesses an ability to lead and inspire. Joining us on the program today to discuss this is Ramtanu Mitra, who is the Bureau Chief for the Executive Intelligence Review in New Delhi and also does quite a bit of work in Washington, D.C. when he's in this country. Tanu, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Harley. I'm glad to be here.
What I'd like to do is just begin with your impression of the role played by Modi last week in his trip to the United States, in his public meetings, and from what we can tell, the effect it had both on the Indian-American community and also back home in India. So why don't we start with that?
Well, Modi here came and basically came here to attend the UNGA. He spoke at the UNGA, and then the Indian American Conference organized a massive rally for him at the Madison Square Garden, where 18,000 or 20,000 were inside and as many were outside. And then he spoke at CFR, Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and then he came over to Washington to hold meetings with White House and have a dinner at the White House. Now, what he did in UNGA itself, what he addressed in UNGA is basically putting United Nations on the map by saying that where is the developmental agenda that United Nations was built upon? All these countries who joined United Nations, and it's now 69 years old, were completely disappointed. UN has been broken up into a number of groups like various Gs, G7, G4, G20. He said, what happened to G1 and or G-all? So he said it's time to put the United Nations on the right track. It is important that development and he said that there exists the technology nowadays which 69 years back were not there. So this technology should be utilized to develop the countries, and that should be the agenda of United Nations. So the United Nations have to set itself, and the reform of the United Nations will be that reset. So that was his basic message he gave to the United Nations. Then in Madison Square Garden, it was rather a rapturous performance in which he basically laid down to the to the mostly Indian Americans who were there, the 40 congressmen were there, Congress legislators. He laid out that he's addressing the youth. It is that the greatest strength of India is that it has 1.25 billion people. That is my greatest strength. That's what makes me a strong person. And then he said that while all the world leaders are worrying because of elderly population, which is cutting down their productive workforce, I have got 60% of India's population is below 35 years of age. So I have got a leg up on everybody else. So there is nothing to be despondent about. We are going to grow. We are going to get stronger. We have to do things. We are capable of doing things. We have sent an interplanetary spacecraft on the Mars orbit.
So this, Tanu, was a very ringing call to be optimistic about.
Very optimistic. And join me, as you were saying, that I'm a small person. I used to sell teas, and from selling teas, I have now become a prime minister. So I'm a small person, but I think about small person, but I think big things about small person. So some people tell me, why don't you take small and simple ideas and make it work? And he said, now if I had been doing that, people wouldn't have got me elected. They got me elected as prime minister because I can do big things. So for me, it is India has to be brought back into the front line of all the nations, and it is time now, and I have the resources, because the most important resource is my youth.
So that Tanu, let me ask you, when he says India has to be brought back to the front line, there was a period of time in the, I guess, the 50s, 60s, even through the 70s, where India played a key role in the so-called non-aligned movement, the role of Nehru, Indira Gandhi, but it's been somewhat eclipsed in the last 30 years. I assume he's appealing back to that sentiment that came out of the experience with independence.
Right. I think that in the 50s and 60s, what India did, and that at that time, of course, they didn't have any resource, and there were a lot of, because of the Cold War situation, India was pretty much isolated at that point in time, but they put in place two very important things, and Nehru, I give credit to Nehru for that. One is the nuclear program, nuclear energy power program, and the space program. And later, of course, Mrs. Gandhi took on the agriculture thing to make India food self-sufficient. But when that was done, and that was done by the, at the time Mrs. Gandhi was assassinated, that 1984, India was in a position at that point in time, given the push, could have been prosperous as China is today. But the next 30 years, at about 26 years or 27 years, nothing was really done. And Modi, that's why in his address at Madison Square Garden, says that you have to realize that after 30 years, here is a government which is a single party government, which has got the mandate from the people. Before that, these 30 years, we are having this coalition government. So those things are thing of the past. Let's get back to the situation that it was in 1984.
And Tanu, after the assassination of Mrs. Gandhi, what was it that was done that stalled that potential that had been opened up by Nehru and Mrs. Gandhi?
Well, the problem that came in 1989, Soviet Union went down. From 1984 onwards, there was this tremendous, since there was really not much leadership that existed, the leadership was challenged by various forces. Some of them were basically IMF, World Bank crowd, who were saying that India's developmental policy doesn't depend upon free market, it's full of protectionism and all that kind of thing, and it's very state owned facilities, private sector is not being encouraged and all that. So it is time to open up reform and all that kind of thing. Now, without having the technology, without having the infrastructure, those kind of things are dangerous things to do. So those leaders, I give credit that they didn't do it. But in the process, they stalled all this, and they were basically more interested to fight and protect what they have than to go forward and do what is necessary to be done. I think they're weak people, weak leaders, and that's why that happened.
And this was pretty much, as we're talking about the situation in India, this is pretty much what happened around the world,
yep.
That most of the developing sector, under the impact of the International Monetary Fund, the deregulation, the free trade policies, the development was taken off the table.
Right. That's exactly what it was. And in India's case, of course, because of the size of the population and because of the looting and devastation that was done by the British colonial power, enormous amount of work needs to be done, needed to be done then, needs to be done now. So it needed enormous amount of international participation, but instead of international participation, what India was getting at that time, particularly during the Cold War time, since they didn't join the so-called free world policies, their nuclear power program was sabotaged. They were not allowed to get any nuclear-related material and equipment. So everything had to be done, and the wheel had to be reinvented and all that kind of stuff was going on. And that took a lot of energy and resources away from what little they had. And
what Modi faces today, you have this irony on the one hand of the successful Mars mission that he was able to preside over, and I assume it brought a great deal of pride to people of India. But then you also have the other thing he brought up yesterday or 2 days ago when he returned, which is the need for sanitation, the need for plumbing, things that we in the West take for granted, even though we're losing it.
Yeah.
How much does the space program resonate with the younger people in India? Is it somewhat similar to what the John F. Kennedy moon mission had for people growing up in the early 60s?
Well, I think it does. It does in the sense that until and unless the leader wants to project this thing as the greatest achievement, greatest scientific achievement, all done by ourselves, and if we can do this level of technological, prove this kind of technological excellence, then we can do these little things like cleaning the place, you know, putting in water and in a power and all that kind of thing. That's the way he addresses things. He said that if we can do this, then why can't we do the simple things? So all that is needed is leadership and organizing the people to do these things and make them understand how these things help them in overall development of our improving the quality of life. This is also the kind of thing that Gandhi used to say, but what is Modi's interesting thing is, Modi is a self-educated person. For all practical purposes, there is absolutely nobody could say that he had great a science background or anything like that, but he said that he had personally seen every rocket launch that Indian Space Research Organization has made. He is in a way, you can call him a space buff. And then also, after he became prime minister, he personally visited the largest atomic research center in India, Bhabha Atomic Research Center, where there are about 12,000 scientists and technicians work. He went there and he said that, you know, you guys have done this much and we have to do a lot more because, you know, the country needs enormous amount of power and this is an indigenous development. We have to push this thing through fast. So he has this understanding, basic understanding of how these two frontline scientific area, technological areas can really help him to achieve what he wants to achieve, which is the bringing the India's infrastructure level to the world class level.
I just had a chance to read your article in the September 26th issue of the Executive Intelligence Review. You wrote an article, India is ready to fulfill its legacy of leadership. And in it, you outline some of the necessary infrastructure programs that are the large programs that will actually enable some of these smaller things to be accomplished. Can you just give us a summary of some of these broader programs that have to be done, including water, power, and what Modi is prepared to go ahead and do?
Yes, I think that what I personally think, Modi has had very little contact with West. As you know, that he was denied visa by United States when he was the chief minister of the state of Gujarat because of a communal riot that took place, and his government allegedly didn't intervene adequately or in time. But the fact of the matter is that in Gujarat, you get 24/7 power, you get 24/7 water, and everybody gets it, whether it's a Hindu or a Muslim or a Buddhist, it doesn't matter. Everybody gets it. So he has got a basic understanding that these basic infrastructure have to be done in a big way and all over the country. Now, India's problem at this point in time, the large problem that he will face, is that India is extremely power short. And India has coal, but India's coal quality is not very good, so they'll have to import a lot. And at this point in time, China is importing a lot. That not only puts a strain on your foreign exchange earnings, but also it's really a logistical nightmare to have a coal-based power generation system. In addition to the fact that its energy flux density is much less than that of nuclear. But nuclear problem with the nuclear, as I have said earlier also in another article, is that really no country in the world is prepared to develop nuclear power to be its mainstay. And when I say that, what I mean is, in order to develop nuclear power, you will have to, you cannot import your way out. You have to manufacture A to Z items of nuclear. And particularly the most difficult part of it is the heavy engineering stuff, which is the reactors. Reactors, which they call what is known as Nuclear Power Plant Set, NPPS, which is your reactor and your generator, power generator, together. Now, hardly, if you go around the world, you will find that China can produce four of them a year, which is amounts to 4,000 megawatt a year. China is now installing about 500 megawatt of coal a week, which comes to about 26,000 megawatt. And 4,000 megawatt is all it is they can produce from nuclear annually. They can produce. Russia may have capability to do five of those reactors. Japan has the capability to do about 12 of those reactors. So if you add them up, you will not find more than 30,000 megawatt of power worth of reactors can be generated a year. This is what
is that, just to clarify that, is that because of the lack of engineers, or is it also because of the lack of machine tools, the lack of people who are skilled with the technologies? What is the limitation?
The limitation is, I think, that there's no commitment. No, it's no commitment. Everybody, the problem with most of these leaders are that they look for a solution in the short term. So coal, you can, you know, there's no technology. In 3 years, you can set up a coal power plant, and boilers and all these things that are available are plenty. Whereas in nuclear is a high technology stuff, and you have to develop your power program entirely on the based on that nuclear is going to be my mainstay, or only thing that is going to be my power. Nobody has done it. United States.
And do you think Modi has the commitment to follow this through?
I have no idea at this point in time whether he has or not. But he does have an understanding that India doesn't have too many choices left at this point in time. India cannot get too much coal. India doesn't have enough hydroelectric. Of course, he will go with solar and wind a bit, but he also knows how limited is the capability of those energy sources. So he will have to go with nuclear. And his visit to Bhabha Atomic Research Center gives me the hope, because those fellows do understand that this is what is needed. I'm hoping that I will be able to get across to him that a very high level of a very high quality and volume of heavy engineering has to be installed. And in order to do that, you have to bring the youths into the manpower development, into all the other kind of things. Science part of it is already done. There is nothing really in nuclear area that that the science can contribute. It's all there. Now it is the implementation side of it. There are enormous amount of logistics that are needed in order to get it done, and that
what we often call capabilities in depth.
Capabilities in depth. That's exactly right.
We're listening to Tanu Maitra from the Executive Intelligence Review's New Delhi Bureau. Tanu's been involved for many, many years in these kinds of questions of the development problems that are faced by emerging nations such as India. And we're talking with him today in the aftermath of the tour by India's Prime Minister Modi to the United States, and also to developments among some of the BRICS nations. I want to come back to this question of the scientific capability, because it seems to me that one of the things that Prime Minister Modi was talking about was upgrading university education for the youth in India. And I assume that's also a big part of what's needed. I know there are a lot of people from India who come here to Houston who work in various kinds of aerospace and also computers and medicine. What's being done? What plans do you know that he has to upgrade the educational capabilities in India?
Yeah, I think that engineering colleges and scientific institutions, they are getting set up, and I think they will be expedited and all that kind of thing. But the thing to look for is that how he will be able to utilize the BRICS in order to maximize the technological and scientific pool that exists within these five nations. Of course, Russia is a huge pool in this. But again, the problem that I see is that in India, you will find hardly a handful of people who can speak Russian. If you find a handful of Indians who can speak Chinese, and it's vice versa. So if the BRICS have to function as a real, they have to, it has to function as a real engine for development, they must get together and have these institutions where all these engineers and scientists, the young ones, get together, and they have the language capabilities so that they can utilize each other's technological and scientific skill that they have. All of them have pretty good. But whether they are able to communicate to each other in a true way, in a real way, is a question. So I do believe that there will be very many universities and engineering colleges that will be set up. That's not difficult.
Well, then let me ask you this, because this is actually quite interesting. One of the things you hear from neocons in the United States who are opposed to China and say China is bent on world domination, and they say that the Chinese couldn't build anything on their own, they had to steal all our technology. But it's now clear that the Chinese have developed a core of physicists and scientists who are capable of doing that kind of work, that kind of original work that's necessary for a space program to do what they've just done recently with the moon. And I assume it's the same way with India for this successful trip to Mars. So could you just comment on that?
Well, science and technology is nobody's private domain. Everybody has the capability to have an access to it. It may be that particular commercial aspect of particular technology is not available, and that has to be redone. But general technology, I think that all these big nations like India, China, Russia, in particular, they all have it. They all have the technology. The only thing is that where you get in as a capability in depth is that, do you have the materials? Do you have the power? Do you have the logistics? Now, those countries who have that, like, for example, European countries and the United States before, they had all of these things together. So science and technology really flourished, or the downstream side of the science and technology really flourished, because those capabilities in depth were built up. The problem was that China didn't have the capabilities in depth, but now they're developing capabilities in depth. So you can now see it very openly that it is not stolen or anything. It is that capabilities in depth has allowed this downstream side of the science and technology to appear in a big way. And on the other hand, under Russia, I don't see it because the capabilities in depth has not been done. In India, it has started to appear. In Japan, well, it appeared, and Japan did wonderful with the science and technology.
Now, talk a little bit more about the importance of the BRICS to an American audience, which is Helga Zepp-LaRouche, has become people living in the land of the clueless. Now, we get very little reporting on what's actually happening in the BRICS stations, what the potential is. The one thing you get is conspirophiles on the right who say, well, this is an operation against the United States. This is part of the New World Order. So can give us a little bit of what the emergence of the BRICS means to Americans, the potential to have these countries have a, in a sense, a leapfrog to new technologies, new technological skills. That's not a threat to the United States, but actually something that we should be supporting.
Right. Well, I go back to what Modi was talking about in the United Nations. So basically, the reason that the BRICS had to rise is because of the fact the U.S. and, the, as you say, transatlantic countries had abandoned the path of development and got themselves engaged in this game of geopolitics, which is in a sort of neocolonial stuff. The reason for one simple reason is that Russia, all these years, was not looking towards east. They were always looking towards west. They wanted to develop a strong relationship with Europe. They wanted to develop a strong relationship with the United States, and those were fine. But instead, the policies of these Western countries were such that Russia was pushed to a corner, and now Russia is looking east. Now Russia is looking east by developing its previously frayed relations with China, and then India's relations with China, which was also hostile before. They had to get together. They had to get together because they don't see anything in here, in this U.S. and transatlantic alliance, who are interested in any of the things that they need. They need development, they need, they have India has 1.25 billion people, so is China. They want to develop. And there is nothing they can get from here which would help them to do so. Now, Russia's turning east has given a tremendous amount of boost to the BRICS potential, because as you know, the Russia has a few things, but those are very important things. One is Russia has oil and gas, which neither China nor India has, the oil and gas otherwise is controlled by this Western transatlantic allies, who are somewhat nasty people in Middle East. Then Russia has very sophisticated military technology, which is also very important for developing the defense, which is for strategic purpose is very important. Third thing, Russia has a very strong science base, and that is going to help the Chinese and the Indians. So it's a good match that has developed. India and China has two things going. They have a lot of population, young population, and they are keen in moving forward. Russia has got enormous amount of wealth in real terms, which can be utilized by all three in order to make it into a very strong area. And then, of course, another important thing is that they're contiguous. India has border with China. China has border with Russia. India is, India to Russia is not a very long distance. So, and this huge mass that exists over there is looking out for development. They were victims of Cold War period, and the population around there is highly, are getting energized because of the energetic activities of these three of the five BRICS nations who are located there. So BRICS had to come up. There was no alternative. And in that condition, the conditions have been ripened because that leadership. I think that with BRICS was already there when before Modi came, and India was not going anywhere on that BRICS issue. Now you got an energetic prime minister in India, you got an energetic president in China, Xi Jinping, and you have got an energetic president in Russia, Putin, who is under attack from the West, despite the fact that he doesn't want a hostile relationship with West, but West is attacking him, trying to undermine Russia and all that kind of thing, and trying to take away areas which are contiguous to Russia.
So Russia in the past during the Cold War had fairly good relationships, I believe, with India. I assume that that changed somewhat after 1989, 1990. But is it the case that Putin is coming to India soon? Or
We have India and Russia has an annual summit. And I think this will be the 15th annual summit is coming in December. And we expect a lot of things. Indians expect a lot of things to come about. But, you know, Russia is, in my book, is the bond that makes the BRICS strong. Russia may not contribute in a very direct way to the BRICS development. Money, I think, is, and China will be putting a lot of money in the National Development Bank. India would be able to put in money, and Russia, China will be doing their Silk Road development. India has a couple of plans, three plans. One is Connect Central Asia plan, that is connecting with the Stan countries in Central Asia. Another plan is Look East, which is connecting all the way down to Indonesia. And they have a maritime program that is called Project Mausam, that is Mausam means season. Project Mausam, and China has a maritime silk policy. So the activities are India-China will be much more active, but it is the Russia thing which is the key in order to keep the BRICS growing strong and fast. That's the way I look at it.
And the Chinese president was recently in India. What was the effect of that visit?
President Xi was in India for 3 days, September 17th to 19th. I think that it was a historic visit. He not only committed $20 billion of investment in India, including some high-speed railroads here and there, but what came across from during this visit is that China has come to realize now, at least that came across now, that China has come to realize that India is equally eager to develop. China's problem always was that if India, and India was responsible for it because Manmohan Singh government was not committed to development, that if India continues to lag behind, then eventually India will have to depend on West in order to provide it with protection. Alliance with West, treaty with West in order to protect, quote unquote, protect itself from China. Now, they see that India wants to move forward, India wants to develop, so India becomes strong, and India has a historical tradition of being non-aligned. Now they have come to realize that India is not going to be ever aligning with West against China or any of the Asian countries. So that is, I think, that came across during President Xi's visit, that he's very happy that India has, Modi has taken this development as the prime goal, and to bring India up industrially and infrastructure-wise. So I think that was a very important visit, and you will see the fruits coming through. And already I think that there's another organization that exists over there. It's called Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, which has China, Russia, and a few Central Asian countries. Now they have included India and Pakistan. Iran is also included, but one of the rules in that organizational setup is that if you have any UN sanction against you, then you cannot be a full member. You have to remain as an observer. So Iran has to get out of that UN sanctions. Once they do, then Iran will come in as well. So now that India, China, Russia, other than in BRICS, they are also in this Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which also deals with Eurasia.
Well, and also the one of the things the BRICS finalized at the Fortaleza meeting in mid-July was the establishment of a new development bank. There's a Chinese investment bank that's being set up. They're talking about these things through various channels. How significant is this? I mean, most Americans don't realize that to the extent they know about the IMF, they know it calls for austerity, that it's taken over countries, really, financially. But most don't realize that countries can't get loans, countries can't get credit for development. So how important are these first steps toward the establishment of these new investment banks and development banks?
Well, I think that the best thing you can get a feel of this from reading South African President Zuma's statement. Zuma said, "Now this is the first time I see that I really can develop. I don't have to put down conditionalities in order to develop." And he said, "All these years, now that we are African nations didn't have any chance of development because the conditions that were put in prevented us from either taking the money or prevented us from utilizing the money in the right way, the way we want. And this is the first opportunity I see when I really do hope, and really hope that we can develop." So there's enormous amount of potentiality. At this point in time, only $100 billion have been put in there. But you know, China has has about 1.4 trillion worth of dollars nowadays. India has about $500 billion. Russia has about $300 billion. They're not going to put all of that in there because for trade purposes they need money. But you know, this thing can increase enormously. But more importantly, the principle on which this new development bank has been set up is entirely for infrastructure development. So it is every money, every penny that will go in there will be utilized for infrastructure development. And so that is something which I think once upon a time World Bank had that thing, I don't know, in the 1950s or so, but never got going. But these fellows are now saying that this is what the purpose of development of these things are. And this is not for the infrastructure development of these five countries, but any other country can take money from there.
Well, this, I think, gets to the higher point that Lyndon LaRouche is so excited about in terms of what the BRICS represent and what, in particular, Prime Minister Modi represented. It's not just the space program. It's not just the development bank. But it's actually putting forward the possibility of moving beyond the kind of Darwinian geopolitical domination of the planet that has existed under empires in the past and under the British Empire at present. And I'd like to discuss this a little bit because I was just reading before our discussion here today that there are all these geopolitical journals. There's one that's called the Small Wars Journal that had an article titled U.S. Geopolitics, Afghanistan and the Containment of China. And they put forward what's a fairly common discussion point among these people, which is that you have to pull India into an alliance with the West against China. Now, what's implied, and maybe it's not even just implied, what's explicit in the emergence of the BRICS is the idea of a higher category for measurement of international policies than mere self-interest. It's a redefinition of self-interest. And I'd like you to discuss that as you see it exemplified by what Prime Minister Modi is undertaking.
Well, when Prime Minister Modi was Chief Minister of Gujarat, State of Gujarat, he had visited Japan 4 times. He has visited China 4 times. He also visited other countries in the neighborhood. And what he came and he, the highest amount of investment in India from Japan and China both are in state of Gujarat. So what he came across looking at them, looking at those countries and talking to their leaders is that there is nothing really that India needs from anywhere else in order to develop its infrastructure and its basic manufacturing, not basic manufacturing, but a higher level of manufacturing capabilities. So India, India had never considered becoming part of anybody. India always wanted to be, for all the right reasons, to be an independent nation with 1.25 billion people. You cannot be a part of an alliance anywhere else, but you can be a trusted ally of anybody and everybody. That's what it wants to be. That's why one of the things that Modi always, in every speech I have heard, at least in the United States, is he uses this Sanskrit phrase called Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam. That means world is my family. I do not belong to any alliance. The only alliance that I have is to this world. And so I think this geopolitical nonsense is really self-serving and really self-containing. You are not containing China, you're containing yourself. That's what you're doing. You're isolating yourself from the bigger world, which is now has opened up thanks to China's developments and very many acts of this US and transnational transatlantic nations, which has forced them to work independently and become and develop these BRICS. So therefore, I think this is absolute rubbish in the sense that India will in I was in Japan, I think it was last December, and I was in a conference, and people were asking me about, they're very careful. I am very interested to bring Japan into this BRICS, or the BRICS alliance, because Japan has enormous amount of technology and capabilities. So I was telling the Japanese that the Asia is now is ready for accepting investment and technology. So you don't know anything about Asia anymore because you have lived in US's shadow for such a long period of time. Your foreign policy is exactly the same that was US's foreign policy, and that's not a popular foreign policy in Asia today. Now you have to get out of there. And since you have problems with China, okay, now you can ride on India's shoulder. India has got a very good image all over Asia. So you ride on India's shoulder and go on, invest in there. And there is Russia. You must get close to Russia. And over a period of time, your problems with China will disappear because once China sees that Japan is as interested to interact with its friends like India, Russia, and interested in the development of Asia, Eurasia, where China's security worries are, the situation will develop between China and Japan such that it will be a friendly relationship. So I think that this thing doesn't work. I think these are empty words that are written on papers, that there is a containment of China. Nobody is interested to contain China. Even the Chinese are saying that nobody's other than the United States, nobody's trying to contain us. But at the same time, what the United States can do and the European nations can do is that they can seize this opportunity to join hands with these and bring this troublesome world some sort of peace and stability in this troublesome world. I think that perfectly these three countries are perfectly capable of now to restore trust and faith in very many areas, including Middle East. I think that can be done. But then you have to move away from your geopolitical games that you play and join hands with this country, with these countries who are interested to see infrastructural development, transportation networks, economic corridors, and all these things to be built. And West has the capability to do all that.
So this is Tanu Matro we're listening to from the Executive Intelligence Review, where we're reviewing the developments of the last several weeks, which actually stretch back beyond that. Now, one of the other things that Prime Minister Modi brought was a discussion of the role of Mohandas Gandhi. Of course, 2 days ago was the anniversary of the birthday of Gandhi. I believe it was 145 years ago. And you can't bring up Gandhi without bringing up the question of the British Empire. And I would like to ask you, how much of a sense of recognition is there in the emergence of the BRICS that this is a movement to end colonialism, end that power of empire once and for all? Because as you know, Tanu, in the United States, most people are very blocked on this question of the power of the City of London over Wall Street, the control over our puppet President Obama. And given that India is still part of the Commonwealth Nations and still has residual relations and ties with Great Britain, how clear is it that what Modi is proposing is not just a break with geopolitics, but with the empire which uses geopolitics to enslave populations around the world?
Well, I think that in a very direct sense, what the financial world has done to the developing world, including India, I think that realization has come, has dawned on everybody that the kind of system that the previous former colonial powers have set up, which is basically to keep these developing nations impoverished and poor. And therefore, this is the enemy. The enemy is that this financial system that they have set up doesn't allow development to occur. So that, I think, is evident and clear. But Modi, when Modi talks about Gandhi, he's very specific. He said two things. He says Gandhi had, in Madison Square Garden, he said that Gandhi had two things. One is that he told us that he will give us freedom. And the second thing he said that Gandhi was absolutely fanatic about cleanliness. He said he gave us freedom, and in return, what have we given him back? Nothing. We have to give him back. We have to give him a clean India. So that's what you're saying. Is that Gandhi had two things from which he wouldn't budge: is the freedom from this British colonial rule, and the second was the colonial stuff. But yes, Gandhi does represent in the minds of not only Indians, but also many African countries, even Arab countries, is that a messenger of freedom who wanted the colonial rules to end and who would go to any extent in order to get them out of the foreign land. So Gandhi is important that way. Yes, it is. And I'm glad that Modi has brought it up again.
Well, he also brought up that there was a mass movement for freedom led by Gandhi, which included the U.S. civil rights movement to some extent. Mm-hmm. But he said, now we need a mass movement for development. And this brings us back to what I'd like to conclude our program with, which is that it's been now, 45 years ago that Pope Paul said that development is the name of freedom. And there's been a commitment by Lyndon and Helga Zepp-LaRouche to make this real by economic policies, development policies. And of course, the LaRouches have had quite a history in terms of their involvement for India. So how important is it to have this, in a sense, dialogue between Lyndon LaRouche and Modi, which was carried out by our organizers at the Madison Square Garden rally, where we were able to interact with large numbers of people who had come there to hear Prime Minister Modi. What is the role of the LaRouche movement in terms of shaping this fight of the BRICS?
Well, the movement, and in fact, the LaRouche's involvement, I'm not going back to the 1940s. I'm not going
we'll
back
let
there.
We'll let Lynn talk about the 1940s.
Yes.
It catches up from the 70s.
But what I am talking about is particularly in the after the Soviet Union had collapsed, Lina LaRouche and Yevgeny Primakov are the only two people who came up with the idea that it is time for India, China, Russia to join hands and take control of the world and then do the development and utilize each other's strength. I was involved in 1999. There was a international conference organized by then Prime Minister Vajpayee, and a friend of ours was presiding, was the head of that conference. So there was a Russian Academy of Science, cultural divisions head came there, and from China, the Chinese CICIR, Chinese Institute for Contemporary International Relations, their India hand came, Professor Maji Ali came and all that. So I was attending that conference, and during the conference, and since my friend was head of the conference itself, chairman, one evening we sat down and said that India, we have India, China, Russia here, we should form a triangular association. And India, China, then academician Rybakov from Russian Academy of Science, Professor Maji Ali from CICIR, and my friend Devendra Kaushik, who was the head of the he has retired then, head of the Jawaharlal Nehru University, dean of the Jawaharlal Nehru University International Relations section, we drafted a memorandum, and it was signed by three. I was the convener, and we memorandum and signed it, called a press conference, at a press conference in 1999, and at that time it was, people considered it as a pie in the sky kind of thing, mm-hmm. because, India, China, they cannot even sit together and converse civilly. Russia, China is still having the border disputes and all that kind of thing. But you see how the things work. In 15 years, now they are closer than ever together, and they have really understood that their strength can be utilized in order to develop a much bigger platform, which is the BRICS. Things have, things you cannot tell. You cannot tell when you plant a seed, when it's going to appear and how big it will grow. And it has done. It has done its job, but it is the beginning. But the seed was planted in 1999, and it is the tree has begun to appear, and now the tree has to bloom. And with good leadership, I think it will get done.
And then that brings up the other question, which is, what is the role of the United States in this? We know under Obama, he's cheering on the colored revolution that's taking place now, or they're trying to pull off against China and Hong Kong. You've had recently the threats from the Islamic State that they're going to launch operations inside India, and India has been targeted by some of these terrorist groups. So the U.S. has played a destructive role in this, but what could the United States do if we were to get rid of Obama and get some leadership in the United States?
Well, one interesting thing is that when Modi talks about this, I found it quite interesting, is that when Modi talks about this, is Modi says, United States and India is an entirely different thing than Washington and New Delhi. He said United States and India has a historic relationship, and this historic relationship can only grow. It can get blocked from time to time because of Washington and New Delhi, but United States India relationship will continue to be will grow. There is no question about it, and it is because this growth is based upon human beings, population. They are the real thing. Leader puts a little pressure to go in the right direction. A good leader, some leaders try to block it, but this is the people's relationship, and this will grow. Similarly, I think that, you know, no matter what these, you know, Obamas and similar kind of political leaders come in from time to time, and in India it was Manmohan Singh, the thing is that this delays the process, creates a lot of aberrations on the way. But, you know, the relationship of such large nations cannot be entirely dictated by. And I could go back in history and see the Germany and France. I mean, so many wars have been fought by so many stupid leaders on either side. But Germany and France relationship will remain as two major, most important nations in Europe. I think that the United States will, you know, the Obamas and all these people will be gone one day, and then some, you know, some people will start to look around and see, hey, we have got isolated in this whole process. You know, there is no reason to be. That was not United States' mission, ever was. And let's join this thing. And I still have the, you know, it's a large nation with 350, 400 million people. We will play a very major role with all the capabilities that we have. I'm fully optimistic about that.
And I think one of the doors that can be open for that is cooperation in space.
Yes, absolutely.
The fact that the United States is now, I believe, using Indian rockets sometimes to put our satellites in the orbit, but that the United States has seen a tearing down of NASA under Bush and Obama, right, where countries like China, India, even Vietnam, other countries are emerging as spacefaring nations. So it seems to me this would be one of the areas where we could see collaboration blossom into something much more profound, provided we did get rid of Obama.
On the day that Modi and Obama were meeting on at the Oval Room, India and NASA signed a joint collaboration on the Mars mission. So there is a tremendous amount of hope that in certain areas, in nuclear area, of course, United States has completely moved out, and it will take almost a generation to rebuild it. But there was a time when that also could have been a very major ingredient in developing relationship with China or India or other developing nations, but that has been destroyed. It will need another leader to bring it back.
Well, Tanu, there are a lot of other questions I'd like to get at, but we're just about out of time. I'd like you to just take a minute to summarize what you see on the horizon ahead. You said you're very optimistic that things can be resolved. What do you think is the most important development that we'll see in the months ahead when it comes to what Modi can do in India?
Well, I think the most important thing that I expect these people will do, and Modi is one of the five or one of the three major leaders, they must realize that it is by their developmental and concern about the poor and those who are you know, economically or physically underprivileged, it is by their act they will be able to bring the rest of the world together. I mean, I don't think that the world will sit around and hang around West and transatlantic US and transatlantic countries if these five BRICS nations can produce at a very rapid rate their agenda. Then you will see the entire world will go in that direction, because I think that's the natural instinct of every country's people, because, you know, leaders may be different, but people are always interested to see their generation and the generations to come become better.
This is what Mr. LaRouche spoke about a lot last night in his weekly webcast on Friday on this question of immortality.
Yes.
And I think that's a good place to end the program. For those of you who have been listening, the last two issues of the Executive Intelligence Review have contained really a great deal of background material. The September 26th issue, the headline is President Xi in India, an alliance to benefit mankind. The October 3rd issue, led by the BRICS nations, mankind is remaking himself, with a nice picture of Prime Minister Modi on the cover. So get these EIRs, get your friends to listen to this program, And we've got some work for us to do. Modi introduced us to the potential, but of course the LaRouche movement has already been there. We've got to get the United States out of the British Empire and into the BRICS. So Tanu, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Harry. It was fun.
And we'll be back next week with another edition of the LaRouche Show, 3 p.m. Saturday.